This is the You Can Learn Chinese podcast, part of the Seneca Network from SUP China. For everyone who's trying to learn Chinese or reaching for the next level, you came to the right place. I'm your host, Jared Turner, longtime resident of China, co-founder of the Mandarin Companion Graded Reader series. And some of my friends have been making very hurtful remarks about my choosing to wear mittens rather than gloves. But I don't like to point fingers. My co-host is John Pasden, co-founder of Mandarin Companion, founder of All Set Learning, the Chinese Grammar Wiki, Sinosplice.com, and today is now older than he's ever been. Does handwriting characters help us learn characters better than typing? Today, John and I will settle this debate by turning to the research studies that address this very question. Interviews with Eileen Wu, a heritage learner who decided to get serious about learning Chinese and did a head-first career dive straight into China. All this and more, let's get to it. Hey guys, this is Jared Turner coming at you from Utah in the United States.
Hey everybody, I am John Pasden. I am in Shanghai, China. I'm recording at night. I am wide awake. How about you, Jared?
Oh, I'm awake. I'm awake. And you know, this is kind of fun. I guess a lot of listeners may not be aware, but you know, I'm in North America. You are in China. We have a little time difference, don't we?
Yeah, so normally I record my late morning and it's your evening, but now the tables are turned, aren't they?
That's right. Still rubbing some sleep out of my eyes. So, but hey, nothing to start the day off like recording a podcast.
And if Jared sounds a little bit groggy, he's not faking it. But anyway, we've got a good podcast for you guys today. Great topic.
But before we do that, we do have some reviews. John, you want to kick us off?
Sure. This is from a listener in Finland. I've been learning Chinese since high school, started 4 years ago, with periods of learning Chinese intensively and periods where I didn't study almost at all for a year. Learning Chinese has been my long-term goal for many years, but this autumn I decided to step up my game with starting university Chinese lessons and really putting effort into practice. And finally, after years of not really getting anywhere, I feel like it's taking off. This podcast is one of the biggest factors for this change. Two funny and smart guys just talking about learning Chinese. Tips and tricks, stories and interviews with super interesting and different people just motivate me. It has showed me that learning Chinese is a long process with all kinds of different ways of going about it, and other people have suffered the same problems as I have. With stories and lessons from this podcast, I've been more motivated than ever to learn Chinese and feel like I can do it. Thank you guys and Happy New Year. Hope you keep doing this podcast for a long time. Best regards from Finland, Lee Sek. P.S. What made learning Chinese your passion?
Wow, very cool. Glad to know we have some listeners up there in Finland. It's cold this time of year.
Have we talked about that before, Jared? What made learning Chinese our passion? Why don't you go first?
No, I don't think we really got into that, really. You know, honestly, I hate to say it, but I don't think I would have learned Chinese had I not moved to China. But I think for me, it became a matter of, you know, survival, functionability, but then it became something also I want to be able to pass on to my kids for them to kind of learn and grow. And so that's something that's really kept me going on learning Chinese.
Yeah, and for me, it started with Japanese. Learning Japanese was kind of curiosity. I had a chance to go to Japan, and that made everything really interesting. And I think it was the characters which really piqued my interest in China. So then I went to China after university. Wasn't planning to stay very long. I just wanted to check it out and have an adventure. And yeah, the country hooked me, and the challenge of learning the language hooked me.
All right, our next review comes from Caleb Winterburn. And he left a comment on YouTube. Now, just so you guys know, we do have all of our podcast episodes on YouTube. So if that's easier for you, you can listen there. This guy, Caleb, runs an aviation insurance YouTube channel. Interesting. All right. So here's what he says. Great podcast. Hope you guys continue to grow even more so in 2022. I've been listening for a long time now, and your podcast has really helped me continue to study Chinese and progress my language learning abilities. So keep up the great work. Well, thanks, Caleb. We really appreciate it. And hope that your Chinese levels soar higher and higher.
Yeah, thanks, Caleb. We'll keep it up. Okay, so today we're going to talk about a paper. And I should say first a thank you to Matt Koss. He's a Chinese teacher. He's a former guest on this show. That would be episode 66, 8 Tips for Using Your Dictionary. Because he brought this paper to our attention. So the paper is called Typing to Replace Handwriting, Effectiveness of the Typing Primary Approach for L2 Chinese Beginners by Phyllis Zhang, or Zhang Ni Lao Shi, and she's a professor at the George Washington University.
I'm really excited about this, John, because this is something that can back up this debate of handwriting. You know, is handwriting or typing better for learning Chinese? So, I mean, we're going to really dig into this here. This is excellent.
Yeah, and I want to mention that way back at the beginning, episode 5 of this podcast, we did actually talk about this topic, writing characters, is it worth your time? But this was kind of anecdotal, some of our own opinions, other people's stories, whereas the paper we're looking at today is actually a study, you know, with lots of students over many years, you know, a very professional endeavor. So it's really cool to get the academic results of such a study.
Absolutely. So let's get to it.
It is a common assumption in the teaching Chinese as a foreign language field that handwriting Chinese characters, hanzi, is a prerequisite for hanzi reading and memorization, and that typing instead of handwriting hinders Chinese as a foreign language beginners' literary development. Okay, so she starts out by pointing out that a lot, and she's talking about other teachers for the most part here, a lot of people feel like handwriting is good, typing is bad. All right. This study provides evidence for the contrary. All right. So this is pretty exciting because this is a study that goes contrary to the common wisdom in the field.
Yeah, this is great because this isn't just Chinese teachers. I mean, I've interviewed a number of people for this podcast, and there's been quite a few who said, really learning characters, you got to handwrite them. You know, you really learn the strokes and it helps stick in your memory, and, you know, and you got to handwrite them. So that's, I've even had some people go as far to say that, hey, there's no real any other way to really get them into your brain.
Yeah, and I hope everyone realizes that when we have guests, they're stating their opinions. And of course, a lot of the experts would agree with what they were saying, and that might be where their opinions came from. But there are also Chinese teachers in the field who are, you know, fighting for new ideas, a more modern approach to learning Chinese, and we're learning the results from one such researcher. So to back up that kind of prejudice against typing and the preference for handwriting, the author states, the Chinese writing system has been regarded as the greatest barrier to learners of Chinese as a foreign language. The traditional stroke-based handwriting memorization method is laborious and time-consuming, demanding tremendous cognitive resources. For Chinese as a foreign language beginners who have very limited time for Chinese learning and need to prioritize oral skills, the handwriting memorization method is distracting and counterproductive because of its inefficient use of cognitive resources. All right, so I love how she doesn't mince words here.
I think it's important to also reference just where does this come from? From my point of view, it's an outcropping of, you know, thousands of years of Chinese traditional culture, you know, in learning the language. In China, kids in elementary schools learn to write characters by hand. It's a big part of the whole educational system. And you go further back, I mean, John, before we even had typing, right? You go back to even like the imperial exams and stuff. I mean, handwriting was something that was prized. It was like you had to have very good handwriting, you know, and learn to write characters in order to like get a good job. But obviously things are different today.
Yeah, and the great thing about this part of the paper is that she follows this statement with a bunch of references, and one of them is Moser, 1991. So that's David Moser. That's someone who's been on our show back in episode 8. And he's also the author of the paper, Why Learning Chinese is So Damn Hard, which we focused on in episode 68 of our podcast. But she's actually referencing that paper, the Why Learning Chinese is So Damn Hard paper. So I think that's kind of awesome, too. And then she says, conceivably, struggling beginners are further demoralized by memorizing new characters that come every day, in addition to repeatedly practicing previously learned ones. Indeed, hanzi retention is a daunting task for learners. So it's really great to read this introduction. Like, you get the sense right away that this teacher gets it, like this this professor, this researcher, she gets the struggles that we learners face.
Absolutely. And if any of you have ever felt this way, you know, raise your hand, right? I think everyone's got their hand up, I think. Is that as far as I can see, John? You know, in this paper, John, she cites a number of other papers that actually address this subject, you know, in part. And I thought it was very interesting because I hadn't heard about some of these. But, for example, there was one research project that's found that groups that didn't really focus as much on handwriting, they performed a lot better in both character recognition and handwriting tests. So that was interesting. They had like less handwriting practice, but they did better on handwriting and they recalled things better. But I thought, John, what was interesting is that they cite another research paper that found, it says that like handwriting supported like understanding like the individual characters, but didn't support as well like the sound and the typing of a character, and also like the sound and the memory of the character. So it, to me, it almost seemed like, you know, handwriting characters, it could be more equivalent to like just doing lots and lots of flashcards, which, you know, is great to help you like remember that individual word, but it may not be as beneficial, and oftentimes is not as beneficial to actually being able to help you use that in a sentence or have an overall comprehension of how that language works.
Okay, before we get into the details of the study, though, let me just make clear here that this researcher sees that the most significant breakthrough for you know, models for learning Chinese in recent years was the advent of pinyin-based word processing, a game changer. So she sees that as super significant, despite the fact that many Chinese teachers think the traditional handwriting approach is best. And she also mentions that despite the successful practice of pinyin typing in beginners' courses at American universities, stroke-based handwriting memorization has remained the primary practice in the CFL field. Most U.S. classrooms continue requiring the handwriting memorization routines. Okay, so I just want to make it clear that if that's your experience, it's because that's normal. That's what's going on everywhere. But there are pockets of revolutionaries which are, you know, pioneering the pinyin stuff. So with all that background out of the way, let's talk a little bit about what the study actually was. Like, how many people were involved here?
Okay, to design this study, here's what she did. She got 108 students. These are college students, I assume. It looks like 18 to 20 years old. And the first group, they did daily handwriting and memorization, and they did weekly sentence reading, things like this. So the second group, they did some balanced and what they call reduced daily handwriting. So they did like daily handwriting stuff and memorization, but not as much. They also did do some reading and typing as well. The third group, they did daily practice, like with a character word list. Using like Quizlet, and very minimal hand copying. So they didn't do a lot of like handwriting at all. They really focused on typing.
Yeah, and the cool thing is that she did these over the years. So the earliest group was in 2015. And then later on, she kept everything the same, you know, the material they were studying, but changed the methods. So 2016 and 17 was the kind of combined balanced approach. And then from 2017 to 2019, the full typing approach. So she was able to compare them by keeping the variables constant, and that's how she got the results. But also I should mention that she made sure to only include what she calls true beginners as her test subjects. Mm. So they couldn't have, you know, spoken proficiency before they started the course. They couldn't, you know, have some familiarity with characters, you know like fluent Japanese, you know, that kind of thing.
That's very good as baseline. In fact, it even plays a little bit into our interview today, who started up, who essentially was a heritage learner. Her parents were Chinese, but you know, she still had a lot to learn. But you know, she didn't start at zero. So these people starting at zero.
Okay, so we're not going to get into all the details of how the study was conducted, but you know, it was a Chinese class, so you know, there was writing, there were tests, there were writing tests, as well as, you know, spoken parts. And she was focused on the character acquisition typing compared to the handwriting memorization method. So before we get into the actual conclusions of the study, I want to read this student's reflection, one of the students that participated in the study. So this is what the student said. Handwriting isn't integral to learning Hanzi. What I've found is that whenever I handwrite Hanzi, I end up mindlessly writing without really thinking. Even if I actively concentrate on what the word is, I get so caught up in making sure the word is written perfectly that instead of learning how to recognize the word, I learn the task of writing instead. Typing, on the other hand, allows me to learn sentence structures and how to view and recognize Hanzi in relation to other words rather than individual words or the act of writing.
Wow, that's excellent. I mean, if you think about it, if you are handwriting, you're practicing writing characters, you frequently will write that character, you know, you'll fill up, you know, 10, 50, 100, you know, iterations of that character on your page. If you're typing, there is no reason to just like type out like 100 characters of wall, you know, all next to each other. Why would you do that, right? You're typing to actually like write something, to communicate something.
Yeah, but here's the key thing, and this is in the paper, you know, in depth if you want to read the full paper. But when you're typing in pinyin, you have to think about the word, you know, how do you say it? And that leads to the pinyin, and then you can input it. So you're not focusing on the form, you're focusing on the sound, which, you know, ties into listening and speaking more closely, and then you're recognizing it, right? So it's a different focus, and there's a lot of discussion in the paper about, you know, well, cognitively, what's actually happening? Like, what's the model for the steps going through, you know, the learner's mind and all this? But, you know, of course, we can't prove any of that, but clearly it's different. And I think we can agree that the important thing is the results of the study.
All right, well, John, we'll stop keeping us in suspense here. What were the conclusions?
Okay, well, first of all, it's not just like one is better, because there are a bunch of different ways to compare. So forgive me for reading from just a little bit of the paper here, because there are a couple different aspects that you have to compare. So first of all, comparable reading comprehension. Okay, so just reading comprehension, pretty much the same. Two, longer typed essays with pretty much the same amount of mistakes and characters. So, you know, everyone's going to make a few mistakes. They didn't make more mistakes, pretty much the same amount as the people who were handwriting and supposedly were super good at it, right? And the people who are typing could actually write longer papers in less time.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, heck, I even think just in English, I can type a lot faster than I can handwrite. But I know with Chinese, I mean, man, you know, it can be pretty slow writing those characters sometimes, especially if you come across that character like, how do I write this?
Okay, but these next two are the kickers, and they're really interesting. So number three is better word and sentence level word recognition. So what that means is because you're inputting pinyin as words, like you don't do it character by character, right? You usually do it word by word or phrase by phrase. So you're focusing on words and you're focusing on, you know, chunks and sentences. So because the act of typing reinforces that, you're better at recognizing words and larger chunks and understanding sentences.
I got to say, that makes a whole lot of sense to me. Because, yeah, when you're typing pinyin, like you were saying before, and that the paper is saying here, is that you're focusing on the meaning, the sound, right? And I think about that if I'm, you know, writing characters, you have to focus. I mean, there is an element of you that has to focus on every individual character, right? You have to make that recall of how that is written in addition to trying to think about the meaning. So it just seems like there's a lot more that might be clogging up, you know, your memory processing and your brain power, right? When you don't have that, it's freed up to do more things, as I think as the paper is pretty much indicating.
Yeah, like we've all had that problem where you're trying to write something and you're like, how do you write this character? Is this part on the top or is it on the side? And, you know, you can just sidestep all that. But number four, I think, is maybe the most surprising and one of the most interesting results of the study, which is better cumulative word phrase retention. So just how much are they forgetting? And you might think like, whoa, if you're not writing it by hand, it's not really imprinting on your memory. And, you know, you're just typing, you're just going to forget all that. But that's not what the study found. They actually retained the characters that they learned even better than the handwriting memorization group.
You know, this is something about, you know, I think just an element about learning any language. It's about the time and the exposure that you put in. And I think, you know, learning to handwrite is a huge investment in time. And I've mentioned this a lot of times before, but when my son was in a local Chinese school, I would stay up writing characters with him, you know, like almost every night. We'd take like spend like half an hour, sometimes an hour, writing characters. And if I just think about that, and that's how I learned to write a lot of characters, but, you know, and I've forgotten a lot of them. But if you just took that time and say, hey, well, instead of like writing all these characters mindlessly, let's read. Or heck, even flashcards would have been better, right? I mean, a lot of things you could have done, I could have done, or you can do to actually practice or other things to you know, learn Chinese as opposed to just learning how a character's written. that it can go a long way. And I'm not surprised to hear that that fourth point here, that people who are not focusing on handwriting are have better retention of the language.
All right, but there is one area that the handwriting group performs better, and that is recognizing individual isolated characters. So, you know, it's not a word. It's maybe like half of a word. Like, this is where writing that character over and over helps you remember, like, a part of a word which you will not actually encounter by itself when you're reading.
Well, there are benefits. There you go.
Yeah, like, I don't know. I don't feel like that's that's a huge loss. So Phyllis Zhang writes, despite weakness in recognizing isolated characters, typing primary learners can successfully read, retrieve, and retain Hanzi in meaningful chunks of words and phrases if typing rehearsal is regularly maintained. In contrast, handwriting learners who are generally stronger in character recognition may fail in word-level performance.
All right. Well, there we go. I mean, I think that's pretty definitive. Now, if you're that person that's sitting there like, hey, I've been handwriting characters, and I mean, for me, that's the only reason I'm really learning and remembering these characters, you know, I think if you're in that camp and you're in that boat, that's fine. Go ahead and keep writing characters. You know, it's something I think if what's in follow your passions. But if you feel like it's kind of like a millstone around your neck, like the albatross, you know, whatever, it's like, you know, you don't have to do that. And there are some more effective ways, on average, for most people to learn characters.
Yeah, and I'm personally a little bit torn about this because I actually really like characters. Characters are one of the reasons I became interested in Chinese in the first place. They're just so cool. That doesn't mean, though, that I want to write characters over and over. It also doesn't mean that if I don't have beautiful handwriting or calligraphy or whatever, that I feel like my Chinese isn't good enough. Like, my handwriting is okay. It's not beautiful, but it's okay. And I can still like characters, you know, be interested in the history of characters, the structure and all that, but not be, you know, all in on writing by hand.
So if you are that super OCD guy that loves handwriting characters and that's the only way I can learn, then do it. Okay. You know, it's fine. But I think really, you know, and we've mentioned this before, John, is like, oh, how often do you really have the need to handwrite characters?
And even if it hardly ever happens, that's something to think about. Like, if you ever have to write your name in Chinese and it looks like you've barely ever written it before, maybe you don't want that experience. Because clearly lots of handwriting is going to get you better handwriting in Chinese. You're going to have better knowledge of stroke order, obviously, better knowledge of exactly how the characters are composed and balanced and all that. And you're going to have better individual character recognition. But, you know, do you need that? So it's just something to think about.
And to put that in context, John, is like, do you need that? Because you got to remember, if you do pursue like handwriting characters, it's usually at the cost of something else. So that's from my economic education, you know, opportunity cost, right? For every moment, you know, every hour you're handwriting characters, you're not doing something else. Now, if you wouldn't be doing anything else, you know, with that time, you know, maybe that it's not a big deal. But if you find it's detracting perhaps from your other things, which could be more productive and help your Chinese move along, and some of us have very limited time to learn Chinese, then yeah, keep that in perspective and focus your time and effort on those activities that are going to help you get closer to your Chinese language learning goals.
All right, and we just want to conclude this this segment by thanking Zhang Ni Lao Shi, Phyllis Zhang, for this awesome research, which was, you know, like, what, 5-6 years in the making, and also for Matt Koss for bringing this paper to our attention. There's so many great Chinese teachers out there which are really, really fighting for us and trying to help modernize the whole field, and we appreciate you.
And if you have something like this that you think would be great for the show, feel free to hit us up. We'd love to hear it. All right, now it's time for a word from our sponsor. Today, our sponsor is
Mandarin Companion, Chinese graded readers.
Today, we're talking about our breakthrough level graded reader, in search of Huama.
So, characters. That would be the character for flower and the character for horse.
I gotta say, John, this is my favorite breakthrough graded reader. I don't know what it is. This story is written with a little bit of the idea of like kind of an Alice in Wonderland kind of experience feel. But it's really cute. Boy wants to get a special present for his mother and is searching through the hills for some flowers and has a unique encounter and is somewhat transported to a different part of China and has some adventure.
Yeah, so this is the only breakthrough story we have that's kind of a fantasy novel. So it's pretty cool and definitely has that that traditional Chinese feel to it.
So you can go out and get it today. It's In Search of Huama, our Mandarin Companion Breakthrough Graded Reader, using only 150 basic characters. You can find it on Amazon, Kobo, or iBooks, or wherever you get your books.
Go read it and let us know what you think.
All right, now it's time for rants and raves. John, what do you have for us today? Do you have a rant or do you have a rave?
I have a rave. I just want to acknowledge a really awesome Chinese teacher, someone that I met in the past. And sadly, he left us last year. I'm talking about Dr. Tim Xie, Xie Tianwei Lao Shi. And I actually met him way back when I first started working at Chinese Pod, and he visited our studio because he was so excited by, you know, this kind of new media that technology was enabling. And this is a guy who, you know, he grew up in China. He taught Chinese at California State University at Long Beach. But he was like a tireless proponent of technology and the benefits it can bring to learning Chinese. And it's become more common over the years. You know, that's why we have papers like the one we talked about today. But like when he started, it was pretty uncommon. Like, you know, handwriting memorization method was all there is. And he was on top of the new technology from the very beginning. So I think we learners all have a debt of gravity. So I think we learners all have a debt of gratitude to Dr. Tim Xie for the work he did. And the rest of us just have to keep up the good fight.
Sounds like he was a definitely an influential person. I'm glad he did the work he did.
For sure. And Jared, what do you got?
I have a rave. Here at Mandarin Companion, I've been working hard on an article with a writer reviewing some smartphone apps for reading Chinese. So I just want to kind of give a plug for this because it's actually, we spent a lot of time on this and we reviewed the 5 best apps for reading Chinese. And we went through, I mean, funny enough, there's not a lot of like apps out there for just like reading Chinese. Now, there's a lot of stuff out there like will have, you know, content that you read on their app, but there's not a lot out there where you can like pull your own stuff into this app and actually read Chinese. So we only really found like 5 that were just like dedicated reading, you know, app platforms. And so I'll just give a plug for the 5 of them. There's a Readaboo, Playco, Link or LingQ, Kindle, and then was kind of a bonus one for advanced learners is QQ Yedu. This is actually written by Simon Linsev. And he's been doing some articles helping out with us here at Mandarin Companion. And so he put a lot of work into this. We both put a lot of work into this. So if you are looking for an app to like read Chinese and you're not sure, hey, what are my options out there? Go check out the article on our Mandarin Companion website. We'll also put a link to it in the show notes. It should really help you identify, hey, which is going to be the best one for me. And really, it's funny enough, John, there's not like saying, oh, this was the best one. Right. It kind of depends like what level you're at and what you're interested in doing. So, you know, I suggest, hey, go take a look at that and you can find, hey, what's going to be best for me.
Cool. Well, obviously reading more is going to help your Chinese. And remember, you can learn Chinese.
My name is Eileen Wu. I am a design researcher by trade. I was born and raised in Honolulu, Hawaii, went to school in California, lived in New York City, and now live in Shanghai, China, which has been my home for the past 11 years.
Eileen has spent a great deal of her career studying and learning all about Chinese consumers, something that has been made possible by the Chinese skills she chose to develop. Stay with us. why did you start learning Chinese?
My parents were actually born in mainland China and immigrated to Taiwan when they were very young. And they moved to the U.S. in the 70s, where both me and my brother were born. So we grew up hearing Chinese at home. But because at the time, in the 80s, it was kind of popular knowledge that it was bad to teach your child too many languages. Otherwise, mm-hmm. they might be delayed in their learning and development. So my parents actually encouraged us to study English and to speak English. So English was really my mother language, although I was used to hearing Chinese at home. Yeah, as a kid, was sent to weekend Chinese school. And I was lucky enough to go to middle school and high school that actually offered Chinese in Hawaii. And yeah, and in college.
Well, I want to get a little bit like better perspective on this. Before you actually got into, let's say, high school, where do you feel like your Chinese was at?
Gosh, I think my Chinese was pretty bad. I probably, my comprehension was probably quite good in terms of household language. And I think growing up, both me and my brother just had no motivation to speak. So a lot of it was like mute, you know, we would listen mm-hmm. and we wouldn't speak. So we'd respond in English. And I was also illiterate, like I could, you know, I could read.
Yeah.
Well, I did learn something in my weekend Chinese class, but for the most part, you know, I couldn't read.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I would say my comprehension was good, but I had very little motivation to speak and very little opportunity to practice speaking.
Gotcha. It sounds to me a little bit like if I were starting to learn Spanish. You know, I've been in here in America. You hear Spanish words kind of around. So you have a little bit of familiarity, at least, with the concept of the language. So how do you think that helped you progress in when you actually decide, hey, I actually want to learn Chinese and start studying it?
I think growing up with Chinese background and hearing it at home, certainly there were a lot of ways in which it was an advantage over starting from zero. I think number one was having a sense or an ear for things like tones in particular. And then the second thing was you have a bit more of an innate understanding for the grammar.
Mm-hmm.
So those two were positives. Sorry, I'll go on a little bit of a tangent, which is, yeah, at the same time, I think there's also this bit of bad feelings as well of not being as good as you should be.
Hmm.
There's ways in which like language is tied to your sense of identity. And, you know, growing up kind of child of Chinese immigrants in the US, you're always kind of straddling these two different worlds. And you're a bit of a bridge of culture between like your parents who can't really speak English and your world of native English speakers. But for me, learning Chinese was like a big part of me feeling more comfortable with my kind of bicultural identity. I didn't want to completely lose that part of myself. But I think growing up, my relatives, most of my parents' friends all spoke Chinese. So like going to family dinners and things like that, you kind of just sit there as this like mute participant, you know, just listening.
I've experienced that before.
Yeah, well, maybe it doesn't matter what language you speak. You're just sitting there listening to your parents. It just felt like, hey, there's this part of the world that I just don't have access to. I remember growing up and like visiting my grandparents and I could barely communicate with them. You know, that was a bit sad. So I think for all those reasons, just feeling language, the lack of that language means like I can't actually communicate with a big part of my family and my life. I would even say as we're talking about it, I realized that like also even talking to my parents, because my parents had like kind of broken English.
Mm-hmm.
And then once I started getting older, so when you are a teenager, you start talking about more complex things, about your feelings, etc. And my parents not being able to, we weren't able to interface because we didn't have, like mm-hmm. their English was too bad and my Chinese was too bad. So mm-hmm. it became difficult to communicate.
Well, where in your crossroads did you say, hey, I want to use my learning and my language skills and actually like pursue a career or opportunities in China or things that are to leverage my Chinese skills?
Yeah. So I graduated college. I started working in international development, went back to school to get my master's degree. And part of what I had always been interested in was understanding the human experience, human stories. And I realized that I also still had that, you know, desire from when I was younger to really kind of reconnect with this part of my life that I didn't understand. I had actually never been to China. My parents really cut off ties with Asia after moving to the US. And I had kind of come to a bottleneck in my career in New York and thought, okay, what's important to me right now? And number one was I would love to get back onto the ground to actually be talking to people, hearing real human stories, understanding people's experiences as a researcher. And then number two, I want to be able to see and experience and understand China in a way that I simply cannot living in the US. And I thought to myself, okay, I'm going to give this a try. I'm going to save up some money. I'm going to move to China, give myself like 3 months. Yeah, so I put all my furniture in storage. I quit my job. I moved out to Shanghai.
Wow.
And yeah, it was kind of a big leap of faith. And within about 3 months, I was able to find a job doing research on the ground in China for a consumer insights agency. And that's when I think I would say my real, you know, education in Chinese and the Chinese language actually started.
Well, at this point, at what level do you think your Chinese was at?
So I've been a big fan of John's work for a long time. So I was listening to Chinese Pod back in, 2005 in New York. And I was on the intermediate level. I found it really, really helpful. So when I moved to China, you know, I could like walk out the door and order some food and like
That's great.
Have a very basic, boring conversation with somebody.
Which is actually just a great accomplishment. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people listening to this would be like, I can't wait till I get at least to that point, right? But I know your career was going to demand much more than that, right?
Yeah, so doing consumer insight work, you know, that was really very much about going and talking to consumers, listening to them, not just what they were saying, but understanding the meaning behind what they were saying so that we could provide insights and findings to back to our clients. I amazingly got this job. Actually, my first role was to be more of an analyst and a writer. So I actually wasn't conducting interviews, but I was going to field work to really listen to what people were saying and translate that into findings for our clients. And one of our first projects I remember was about understanding motherhood in different regions of China. And I was with my coworker who was the moderator. She was running the interviews. We went to Shenyang, which is in the northeast of China. And the first group of moms that we spoke to were from a slightly like lower socioeconomic class. And they were speaking in Dongbei dialect. And I would say my comprehension dropped like from, I don't know, 70% to about 30%. Even though they were speaking Mandarin. You know, I was at that job for a couple of years and it was just literally intense listening every single day to real spoken Chinese. And that was probably the, you know, I feel super grateful for that experience, not just getting a peek into people's lives, but being able to understand the realness of the language. It comes to life.
Well, how did you handle that? Because, I mean, even 70% comprehension is, it's not good, right? You miss out so much. So, I mean, how did you handle those types of situations and bridge that gap to actually do your job?
That particular situation I talked about before was a rare case, I think, because of the heavy dialect people were using. But I would take copious notes, often in pinyin. I would go back and revise and like look at everything to make sure that I understood correctly. Sometimes when there were foreign clients actually attending our field work, there would be a simultaneous translator there. What I would do is I would wear one headphone of the English simultaneous translation coming in, and then I would listen to the Chinese with my other ear, and I would try as much as possible to listen to the Chinese. And when I didn't understand something, I would like listen to the English to like double check. I mean, I think, again, it was really a crash course, right? That was a chance for me to just hone my listening skills, learn so much new vocabulary, and understand how, again, it's just the way textbooks teach Chinese. It's just so different from like the types of colloquialisms that people use, how they express themselves.
You know, I think that's interesting to hear that perspective, because we did have a translator we had interviewed some episodes ago, William White, and he talked about the difference between having like simultaneous interpreter versus like translating, which was more like, you know, translating texts. He's like, if someone is just talking, speaking off the cuff, it's so much easier to just translate that as opposed to if they've had a prepared speech. They've had really time to think about and develop complex ideas and stuff. And so I think that's kind of interesting, because it sounds like almost like daily conversation, having those conversations over and over and again, you kind of have a lot of repetition of what people are going to say. And maybe they may say complex ideas, but it's not going to be like newspaper difficulty, right, of Chinese that's being thrown at you.
Yeah, this is the way people talk in everyday life. It was people being interviewed about their relationship with shampoo or like how they wash their clothes. But even so, the way people describe things, there's so many things that are not translatable from English to Chinese. And I think developing that sense for how people express themselves in another language is not only, you know, yes, I definitely learned a lot of new words, but you start to see how people see the world.
Can you think of any experience where you were doing some project like that, where you had that experience, maybe where a light bulb went on, or it's like, oh, I finally got that now, or you just feel like you got a new perspective?
There's a lot of things. So we did a lot of beauty-related projects. So when it comes to beauty, like the word 气质 gets used a lot to express, okay, so so-and-so really has 气质. So it just refers to a presence, an aura that people have that comes off as like beautiful or attractive. And usually translators wouldn't know how to translate that. When I first moved to China, you know, we asked what to use, like an attractive male. And a lot of people would use the term yangguang, which literally means sunshine. So the translator would often translate it as sunshine. But what they actually mean, yangguang, it actually connects to like a sunny disposition. It also connects to like having a complexion, like looking very shiny from the inside. And it has to do with this idea of beauty that's kind of like this positive, sunshiny attitude that shows in your physical appearance.
It seems to me, Eileen, like you've done a lot of this market research, and you've had a front row seat to seeing some of the dynamic changes happening, you know, in like just people's everyday lives, right? Just how they perceive different things and how their views on, you know, different products change over time. What do you think some of those shifts are that you have seen, or some of the big changes, I mean, even in the last 10 years that have kind of happened in China?
Yeah, it's been a pretty massive shift. So, you know, after the economy opened up in the 70s and you have an entire generation of people who were coming out of poverty, then by 2015, everyone's interested in the generation that grew up in the 90s, who grew up in a much better situation. And now people are talking about people who were born in the 2000s. And the amount of change that has happened in China in terms of people's sophistication around consumer products is just insane. If I had to use the US as an equivalent, could it be like moving from the 1940s to like now in the period of 10 years? I remember when I first started doing research in China, we were looking at, you know, how can we get men to use conditioner? And, you know, I remember we're talking to a man in Shanghai, you know, Shanghai being a very forward-thinking cosmopolitan city, saying he couldn't use conditioner because his father thought it was too girlish. And like, why can't you just use bar soap? That's what we all use. We use bar soap to wash our hair. And to now, where it is just completely different. You know, a lot of gender fluidity, men exploring different looks, like extremely complicated, sophisticated kind of personal care products.
It changes so fast.
The openness to change amongst Chinese consumers is pretty phenomenal. And a big trend that we've seen with a lot of like foreign companies coming to China is they don't realize how China has completely leapfrogged the West in so many different ways, because the Chinese market and the Chinese consumer economy doesn't have a long legacy of other things in place. So, you know, cashlessness being adopted within a year's time, the ways in which Chinese consumers are really extremely open to AI interacting with like digital beings, it's something that there's not this kind of previous baggage or fear around. So it becomes a place where a lot of things can forge into the future very quickly, which has both its good and bad, of course.
Well, I'd also like to hear your perspective on this, is that you know, there's a lot of individuals, I'm sure some that are listening today, who have aspirations of someday coming, working, or having a career in China. How important do you feel it is learning Chinese to pursuing a career in China?
Yeah, I think if I have to be 100% honest, it's becoming less and less easy to show up in China as somebody who doesn't speak any Chinese and get a job. I mean, since 2015, it's just not as big of a value anymore. For myself personally, being able to speak Chinese while at the same time, you know, my mother tongue is in English and being educated abroad, my biggest value has been more as a bridge to help oftentimes people from outside of China to really understand China better. And I certainly don't think I would be able to do that without the language.
Can you think of some experiences where you're able to act in that role?
You know, there's some brands that have done a great job of like localizing their products and their brands in China, like KFC has done an amazing job, like Pizza Hut. They've done a great job of like catering to local tastes while still retaining who they are as a brand. If I had to give a specific example, you know, we were working for like a beverage company that was trying to like figure out how to get people to drink more water. As part of the research, when the clients were in China, actually delve a bit into things like traditional Chinese medicine and how people actually have a relationship with food and beverage in their lives and how they actually consume it as being quite different from the West. So things like drinking tea all day long, or like the idea of like performative ingredients, is something that has been in China forever. Mm. In the US market, you're seeing things like cumin, carbon infused water, and
yeah,
water with collagen in it. And we're like, well, actually, there's a thread of that that's always existed in China because food is connected to health and performative benefits. So when you think about your product development and what types of products you actually want to bring to China, I think the logic has to be actually quite different. The way people, you know, engage with like food and beverage is just fundamentally quite different from other places.
All right, Eileen, if you could go back and redo any part of your language learning experience, what would you do differently?
You know, I've always been kind of a shy person, and being really insecure about whether or not my Chinese was good enough. You know, I eventually did start doing field work in Chinese. And I think there's always been this nagging feeling of I'm not as good as a native speaker. You know, as a researcher, I can't do proper research without like being able to speak at a native level. And for me, just having a while back, having a mentor who was like, what is it that's keeping you from believing that you can interview people in Chinese? I was just like, I just can't, I'm not good enough. And she was like, can you write out questions in Chinese to ask somebody? I said, yes, I can. She was like, can you read those questions off of a piece of paper? I was like, yeah, I can. She's like, can you understand what people are saying? I'm like, yeah. She's like, you're interviewing a person in Chinese. And I think that was, you know, that was a huge, I think, mindset shift for me. So yeah, I guess a piece of advice to me, maybe when I was younger, was to just kind of, yeah, bite the bullet and also lower my expectations of myself and remember that the best practice is just getting out there and going for it.
Eileen, I really appreciate taking the time to share these insights.
All right. Thank you so much, Jared.
You have been listening to the You Can Learn Chinese podcast. Help us spread the word by sharing this with your friends, classmates, teachers, cousins, builder, maker, comedian, advisor, baker, orthodontist, sledder, economist, and that one gal named Judith. You can subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. And please write us a review so we know how we're doing. You can find us on Facebook and at mannercompanion.com. Apologies to John Cena, we just ran out of time. The You Can Learn Chinese podcast is produced by myself, Jared Turner, and our editor is Kaiser Kuo at Sup China, and our interview editor is James Harper with Filter Productions. I'd like to thank our guest interview, Eileen Wu, and of course, thanks to my co-host, the man, the myth, the legend, John Pasdan. See you next time.